series on Hilchos Tefillah, and I apologize in advance. Don't yet look at the source sheet. We'll get there. But I apologize in advance because I think we said in the previous weeks that we're finally going to get to the halacha of Tefillah, but I came across something this week, and I just couldn't skip over it. And it's something that meant a lot to me, and I hope you'll forgive me for that. But I think it will be meaningful to everyone here as well. So by way of introduction, before we get into this, where are the extra copies that were made? They're all taken? Okay, so we'll have some more. So by way of introduction, what happened was last night, I always make the same amount of copies, but last night I guess people liked it so much, many of them took for their husbands and their wives and their children, and so I guess we ran out. So by way of introduction to what we're going to learn today, let's talk about the following. Rav Soloveitchik writes, it's quoted in the Siddur. They have now a Siddur that's printed from Rav Soloveitchik with a lot of his very beautiful comments. If you don't have it, it's worth buying. It's a really, really meaningful Siddur that was worked on very, very well. So they have there a comment that Rav Soloveitchik made. It's printed in another Sefer, but then they reprinted it in the Siddur, where he wonders, why is it that when the Aseres HaDibros begin, we introduce it by saying, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, the first commandment that we have is you should believe in God. And if I were God, so to speak, and I was trying to convince people that they should believe in me, I would say, Asher, you should believe in me because I am the one. What's my greatest, so to speak, accomplishment, if we can say such a thing about God himself? I would say, you should believe in me because I was the one who created this world, because I was the one who did everything. I was the one who brought you into this existence. But yet, that's not what the Torah says. Anochi Hashem Elokecha, you should believe in me because I was the one who brought you out of Mitzrayim, Asher Hotzeisicha Me'aretz Mitzrayim, which begs our curiosity. Why is it that the Torah introduces the very first commandment, the first mitzvah that we're given in the Aseres HaDibros by saying, Asher Hotzeisicha Me'aretz Mitzrayim? That's not God's greatest accomplishment. He did things, so to speak, that were much greater than taking us out of Mitzrayim, than taking us out of Egypt. So says Rav Soloveitchik as follows. I did not put it on here, so don't look at that yet. And he suggests the following. God is not portrayed here as the creator. Why don't we have an introduction to God as being the Borei Shamayim Va'aretz? Suggests Rav Soloveitchik, because the cosmic experience is too formal and abstract. God does not wish to appear as a tyrant to whom man must submit. He knows that it's overwhelming for us to think of him in the terms of Borei Shamayim Va'aretz. That's too abstract for us. The vastness of the cosmos frightens man. If you would be introduced to the Ribono Shel Olam as somebody who was Borei Shamayim Va'aretz, you'll say, that's out of my league. It's out of my understanding. I have no way of relating to that. He cannot transport himself to the outer fringes of the universe to meet him. I have no way of relating to such a being because it's so out of my stratosphere. The mystics have termed the act of creation as a sacrifice. What does it mean that when God was Borei Shamayim Va'aretz, it was a sacrifice on his part? What does that mean? Suggests from Soloveitchik, what it means is, this is what the Sifrei HaKabbalah, which I have no understanding to, but this concept I think is very understandable, something that they called Tzimtzum. To be Mitzamtzeh means to limit oneself. So why is it limiting oneself to create? The answer is, if God is the one who took up the whole world, if God was the only being, and now he invited others to be a part of his world, now he created all of us, it means he was Mitzamtzeh himself. It means that he limited and imprisoned himself in a way. Because by inviting the whole world to be a part of his existence, he obviously limited himself. And says of Soloveitchik, this is the reason that's too great for us to think about. It's too much for us to relate to. It's too abstract. And that's why when we're introduced to the Ribono Shel Olam and we're told that we should believe in him and we should serve him, we are introduced not, I am the God who created Shamayim Va'aretz, but rather, I am the God who held your hand through the Shibud Mitzrayim. I am the one who took you out of that terrible experience that you had in Mitzrayim. I am the one who's there with you throughout all the different journeys in your life. This is the way we are introduced to God, and says Rav Soloveitchik, that because we are introduced in that way, God becomes, in his words, our leader, our friend, and our guide. Because of that, we have a relationship with him, which is not an overwhelming relationship. It's one which we understand that he understands us. We understand that he's with us. We understand that he travels with us and he goes through all of our experiences in life, and that he, in his benevolence, decided to limit himself and invite us into his existence. Based on that, you'll understand Rav Soloveitchik has a comment in one of the other books that he wrote where he talks about what it means, La'avda b'chalavavchem. We say the Pasuk tells us that we have Avoda Shebelev, that Tefillah is called the worship of the heart. So what exactly does it mean? Avodah Shebelev. Suggests with Soloveitchik as follows. If true prayer takes place in the heart, One does not need a master of ceremonies to mediate between the congregation and the Creator. If I had to say something in a specific way, if I had to be a chazan, so some people have the ability to do that and some people don't. If I had to have a lawyer, if I was going to speak to someone where you have to articulate yourself in a very particular manner, so if I don't have the ability to present myself in that way, I have to hire a lawyer to do that for me. But because we assume that tefillah is avodah shebelev, because we don't assume that it's so much based on what you say, but rather what you feel, therefore there's no need for anyone in the middle. Therefore there's no need for anyone to stand in your place and present that which you feel to the Ribono Shel Olam. Each one of us has the feeling that Asher Hotzeisicha Me'aretz Mitzrayim, that God is my friend, God is my leader, God is my guide. He's one that is always with me in my life. And because of that, we have the opportunity to present ourselves to him because tefillah is avodah shebelev. We don't need a representative in the middle. This is one of the Amni Mamas that we say every day. Says Rav Soloveitchik, Judaism teaches that every individual possesses a heart full of love, conscious or unconscious, whether we understand it, whether we recognize it or not. We all have a heart full of love for God. His heart is as near to the gates of heaven as that of the clergyman, and often more so. Don't think that somebody at Tzaddik or at Tzidkanius is any closer to God than you are. Each one of us has our own relationship, each one of us has a unique relationship, and each one of us has the opportunity to express ourselves in our own way, in our service, in the way we understand our relationship to be. So this, says Rav Soloveitchik, is what an overall understanding of tefillah is all about. We first think about the fact that the Ribono Shel Olam relates to us in a very personal level, as not the Borei Shamayim Baretz, but rather as one who is our friend and our guide, as someone who is Asher Hotzeisicha Me'aretz Mitzrayim, someone who saves us from all of our troubles, somebody who walks through all the difficulties in our life together with us, hand in hand. And because of that, we understand that we have the ability to present ourselves to him, to present our hearts to him. And we don't need anyone in the middle to do that for us. We can do that sufficiently without having a lawyer or an intermediary in the way. Now I'd like to turn our attention and learn through a piece this morning that Rav Soloveitchik wrote in 1978. Rav Soloveitchik originally gave this talk in the University of Pennsylvania. It says there that he was invited by the Hillel House in the University of Pennsylvania in 1978 to give a talk in philosophy. And then he thankfully wrote it over and submitted that article in Tradition 1978. As far as I know, it has not been reprinted. I came across it this week totally by chance. It really was not what I was looking for at all. But I came across it totally by chance and I was really excited and I read through the whole thing. There is no chance, correct? And I was very excited by what I found. I later on told it over to my father, who said he had never read it before either, because he wasn't aware that it was in Tradition 1978. He said he did see a translation in Hebrew somewhere, but he didn't really understand the Hebrew. He didn't think it was translated exactly to the way it probably was said. So he was very happy as well to hear this very beautiful insight. And I believe that it is worth learning through together. Again, I don't think we'll get through the whole thing, but I took out the article itself is 25 pages long. I took out the excerpts that I think are the most important parts. And I think it's worthwhile to take time to learn through it together slowly because it is so beautiful. It is so meaningful. It's so profound. It's so deep. It's so relevant, as you'll see. And at the same time, it is so novel. I think it gives a very novel approach to what tefillah is all about. I don't have much to add. I really want to just learn the words themselves because I think Rav Soloveitchik's words are as beautiful 35 years ago, 40 years ago, as they are today. And as you'll see, it's extremely prophetic, it's extremely authoritative, and it's really predictive in its very nature. You'll see that it really relates to our society and our community. So we begin with the source sheet. I decided to put numbers on the line so that we could follow along a little easier. But here, Rav Soloveitchik is beginning with the following question. The Gemara says in Brachas on Daf Dalid, Hasomech Geula L'Tfila Hareze Ben Olam Haba. Somebody who daven Shmona Esrei immediately after they finish saying Gal Yisrael has a special place in Olam Haba. So this is the principle not only in the morning, but it's the principle in the evening as well. When we daven Shachris and when we daven Marv, we're supposed to go immediately after we talk about the Geula from Mitzrayim. We are supposed to go immediately into our Shmona Esrei. And this is not only the Gemara in Brachas, but the Yerushalmi in Brachas discusses this as well, that somebody who chooses not to recite the Shmona Esrei immediately following the Geulas Yisrael, immediately following the discussion that we have about the time that we were in Mitzrayim and the redemption from Mitzrayim, that's considered to be a terrible tragedy, that's considered to be a terrible transgression, and there always has to be that juxtaposition between Geulas Yisrael and Shmona Esrei. Now Rav Soloveitchik is bothered by that. Why is it that there's any inherent connection between the Geulas Yisrael and the Shmona Esrei that we daven every day? So let's start on line number 5. The halacha has viewed prayer and redemption as two inseparable ideas. The halacha requires that the silent prayer be preceded without a break by the benediction of Gal Yisrael, which proclaims God as the Redeemer of Israel. So he asks, what motivated the halacha to link prayer with redemption? What is the connection? Apparently, he says, our sages considered prayer and redemption to be structurally identical, and he wonders, of what does this identity consist? Now, don't think that this is Rav Soloveitchik's question that he came up with. This question predates him by a few thousand years, by a few hundred years, I should say. Rav Soloveitchik is not the one who came up with this. The Rishonim already have the question. In the 1200s, Rabbeinu Yonah and the other Rishonim already discuss it. They saw that Gemara. The Gemara tells us that we have an obligation to say, Gal Yisrael, immediately before we daven Shmona Esrei, what is the connection, asked Rabbeinu Yonah? Very nice, you talk about the fact that we came out of Mitzrayim, but what does that have to do with the fact that I need a parnasa in my Shmona Esrei? What does that have to do that there's somebody sick in my family and I'm asking God to help us out and to cure that patient? What is the connection at all? So Rabbeinu Yonah writes something, and just by way of introduction to understand Rabbeinu Yonah, let's think about the following. Rav Asher Weiss has said on so many occasions, I think I've said it here on many occasions as well, but it's worth repeating. Maybe somebody doesn't remember it, and if you do remember it, it's worth thinking about it once again. He said over the story about a young child who was sitting the night of the Seder, and his grandfather is sitting by the Seder and recounting all the stories of Yetzias Mitzrayim and Kriyas Yamsev, and the child with total fascination, with great interest, is listening to all the details of the story. And the child finally turns to his grandfather and he says, you know, I'm amazed by everything you're telling me, but I'm just not understanding why you're so taken by it. So he says, why? He says, well, you know, if after all, God was the one who created, who designed, who produced this whole world, he's the one who fashioned the sea and the stars and the cosmos and everything that we have, well then why is it so incredible that he partitioned the sea at a certain period in history? After all, if you create something, you can also take it apart. So why are you so fascinated by the fact that God split the sea for the Jewish people to come out of Mitzrayim if after all, he's the one who created the sea in the first place? So the grandfather tells his grandson, I want to explain to you with a mashal. And he tells him the following. He says that there was an artist, a very proficient artist who was a sculptor, and he was working on a beautiful horse, and he was using all of his professional experience to make this horse as beautiful as he could. And after working on it for months and months, he decided to discuss with his family, how can I get the highest possible bidder on this beautiful piece of art? So his family tells him, we have a great idea. You should go down to Wall Street. You should go down to a very busy neighborhood. Leave it in the middle of the town square before everybody comes to work. Tomorrow morning when they get off the train, everybody will notice this beautiful piece of art. Someone's going to offer a certain amount of money. Someone else is going to hear. They're going to offer a little more. And you'll hike up the price until you get the highest bidder. And then that's who you'll sell it to. Great idea. So he goes early in the morning, 5 o'clock in the morning, before anyone's at work. And he drops it right in the middle of a busy street. And he stands on the side, and as everyone's coming to work, he notices that nobody is even taking a second to bother themselves to look at this beautiful piece of art that's in the middle of the street. And he can't understand, and he figures that maybe the reason why is because everybody is too busy, everybody's just thinking about work, they don't have the mind right now to take time to look at this thing. So he decides he's going to wait there till lunch. Lunch break comes, everybody's in and out, up and down, all around the streets, and once again, nobody notices the fact that he has this beautiful piece of art lying in the middle of the street. So he says, you know what, they only have an hour lunch break, maybe they can't waste their time on this. He's going to wait till dinner time, and he waits till everybody leaves, the end of the day, going to the train. Nobody's looking at it, and he comes home that night, he's so despondent, he's so upset, and he thinks it must be that nobody looked at his beautiful piece of art because he made something that was deficient, he made something that wasn't up to the standard that everybody would expect a piece of art to look like. So he's despondent, he's beside himself, he decides to talk to his family about what exactly went wrong with this piece of art, and finally, after much discussion, his family member says to him, you know what the problem is? You made it look so good. You did such a good job. You're so skilled. It looks like a real horse. Now, when you see a real horse in the middle of the street, there's nothing to look at. It just looks real. So he says, what should I do? I should make something that's subpar? I should create something that doesn't look real? What kind of artist am I? But the problem is, if I make it look too real and too good, who wants to look at that? There's nothing to look at. So somebody has an idea that he should go back the next day, he should bring the horse to the same place, but he should split the horse in half and put one half of the horse on one side of the street and the other half on the other side of the street. And everybody's going to double take because it looks real, but it can't be real. If it was real, it wouldn't be able to be split in half. And it's not until you split it in half that they'll begin to appreciate what the whole was. And that's what this grandfather told his grandson. Yes, God is the one who created the entire cosmos. God is the one who created the sea. Why is it so amazing that he split the sea? Because sometimes we need God to split the sea in order for us to appreciate what the sea was before it was split. We pass by the ocean and we say to ourselves, what's the big deal? The ocean was here, the ocean was always here, will always continue to be here. There's nothing to look at. It's a real horse. And God says, no. Every once in a while I'm going to do an act. It's not a talent show. He didn't have to split the sea to show everybody how great he is, to show everybody what miracles he can do. But he did it to make us appreciate and reflect on what happens every day, that it's a miracle every day that the sea is there. Appreciate the fact that this is a beautiful piece of work, that I worked very hard to make this, so to speak. And it's not until we split it sometimes that we begin to appreciate what was there all along. And this is really what the Ramban writes to us. What is the purpose, what is the reason for all the miracles that we experienced at Kriyas Yamsuf, for all the miracles that we experience in all of our lives? Why is it that we have overt miracles? We're just coming off the holiday of Hanukkah. We all know that we speak so much about miracles on Hanukkah. And we talk about two miracles, and we often put them together. What are the two miracles that we describe? The Nes of the Pach HaShemen, the fact that there was oil that lasted 8 days, and there was a miracle that took place, the military victory. Those two things had nothing to do with one another. Why do we mention them in the same breath, over and over again on Hanukkah? What is the connection between the military victory and the fact that there was a jug of oil that lasted 8 days? We should have two different celebrations and two different mentions of it. But the answer is we cannot. Because very often you have a military victory where the underdog wins and people blame it on natural means. That happens sometimes. Nobody necessarily is going to come out from that experience and say, oh, you see, it was such a miracle that was played out by God. How often do we see in Israel? We are clearly the underdog. We have millions and millions of enemies all around us. And yet somehow we win those wars. And somehow you can have thousands of rockets that fall into a country and they don't hit anybody. It goes into empty fields. What is the probability? What's the likelihood? Well, there are many who argue, naturally that happens every once in a while. Yeah, sometimes you have an enemy that fires hundreds and thousands of rockets but doesn't hit anybody. We all know that that's preposterous. We all know that that's a miracle, but not everybody is going to be able to recognize that. There are many who deny the existence of God in anything and everything that takes place in Israel. There are many who don't believe that it's God. They just believe it's natural. And the reason, says the Ramban, why we have overt miracles is to make us have the opportunity to reflect on everything else in our life that is not so obvious. Rav Asher Weiss pointed out that we have the word miracle as a nes, but nes also has a second meaning. And that is a banner, which means that it's supposed to be an indicator. That when you have a miracle in your life, it's supposed to be an indicator that everything else in one's life is also absolutely miraculous. It's beyond the teva. It's something that is not natural, is not normal. And the miracle, the overt miracle, gives us the opportunity to express that and to think about all the other experiences in our lives that are absolutely beyond nature, that are absolutely miraculous. This is what the Ramban says, Min anisim hagdolim hamafursamim. This is probably the most famous Ramban on Chumash, where he writes in Parshas Bo, the reason, the purpose for all of the overt miracles is She'adam mode benisim hanistarim, is to make a person recognize what the private, what the silent miracles in our daily lives are supposed to be all about. That's what life is all about, says the Ramban. And he continues and he says, Shehu yisod kal ha'Torah kula. This is the foundation of all that we believe in and all that we stand for. And then the Ramban goes so far as to say that anybody who doesn't believe in this, Ein lahem chelek b'Torah Moshe Rabbeinu. Anybody who doesn't believe that this is the foundation of what all of the Torah is about. Anyone who doesn't appreciate the fact that God provides us with miracles every moment of our lives, every second of the day, doesn't have a place in Torah's Moshe Rabbeinu, doesn't have a place in the religion and the theology that we believe in. And the Ramban ends off, Ein bahem teva u'minhaga shel olam. There is no such thing as nature, there is no such thing as convention, there is nothing that is a given in our lives. For anyone who has had anybody sick in their families, very sick, we know that there's nothing that should be taken for granted. We know that there's nothing that's a given in our lives. And this, getting back to our point, answers Rabbeinu Yonah why it is important that we have the juxtaposition between Gal Yisrael and the Shemoneh Esrei. when you think about the Geulas Mitzrayim, there is nobody who can deny the fact that that was an overt miracle. Nobody can deny the fact God's presence was there when we came out of Mitzrayim. There's no other way to explain how a sea splits into all those parts to let a nation walk through it. And says Rabbeinu Yonah, if you recognize that it was God on that occasion, you also need to recognize it's the same God that's going to provide you with the Parnassa, that's going to provide you with the Refuah, with every personal need that you're going to ask Him for in the Shemona Esrei. Says Rabbeinu Yonah, if you're going to split between that experience of Geulas Yisrael from Mitzrayim and the experience of our daily needs in Shemona Esrei, and you think that it's two different realms, that it's two different gods, it's two different powers, you're missing what God's presence is all about in your life. And that, says Rabbeinu Yonah, is why it's so important, it's so essential to have Geul Yisrael immediately before we begin to say the Shemona Esrei, because we have that recognition, we have that realization that everything that we have in our own lives is always ultimately going back to that same overt miracle that God performed on the time, on the occasion of Yetzias Mitzrayim. Anyone who's had, you know, the unfortunate experience of a near-death experience, either in their own lives or in someone that they're close with, understands that that's true, understands that it makes you reflect, it makes you look back on your life and think about, it puts everything in perspective. It makes you think about, why am I here? And what exactly has God wanted from me? Why is it that He took me out of that very dangerous encounter? And why is it that I continue to prevail? And we begin to think more sensitively about the day-to-day miracles that God does provide us with, and we realize that there's nothing in our lives that should be taken for granted. When I was 2 years old, I was shot in the head. I had a bullet in my head for 3 months. I'm still here. I should have died. You don't think it makes me think every so often? So the greatest miracle is that my parents continue to live in the Heights. But barring that, it makes a person wonder. I'm sure I'm not the only one who's had, again, that might be an extreme example, but I'm sure there are many who have had experiences on their own which were very dangerous experiences, but it makes you think back. It makes you reflect. What am I here for? Why was I saved? And it makes a person recognize that they have a sense of purpose, a sense of meaning, and that God is with them all the time. It gives you a tremendous mission. It makes you think about why it is that we're here. So this is what Rabbeinu Yonah writes. This is the reason why we have to have Geul Yisrael right next to the Shemona Esrei that we daven every single day. I didn't mean to do that for the shock of it. Let's land ourselves back in here. So Rav Soloveitchik wants to know, why is it that we have the Smichas Geula L'Tefillah? And as we mentioned, this is not Rav Soloveitchik's question. This is a question that was asked by the Rishonim, by Rabbeinu Yonah in the 1200s. He gives his suggestion. Rav Soloveitchik decides to go in a different direction, and I think it's a very fresh perspective. It's a beautiful perspective to think about, and that's what we're going to learn through today. So let's look at line number 14. And Rav Soloveitchik is trying to figure out, how would you describe the life of a slave? How do you describe what it's like to be in slavery in Mitzrayim? Or for that matter, to be a slave anywhere. Says of Soloveitchik, line 14, the slave lives in silence, if such a meaningless existence may be called life. He has no message to deliver. In contrast with the slave, the free man bears a message. He has a good deal to tell and is eager to convey his life story to anyone who cares to listen. No wonder the Torah has four times emphasized the duty of the father, a liberated slave, to tell his children, born into freedom, the story of his liberation. Why do we have to tell our children? Why is it so important to recount the memory that we have, the collective memory, the communal memory of the fact that we were slaves in Mitzrayim? Why is that so important? Our kids aren't interested. Enough. That was many, many years ago. I wasn't born into that existence. What do I care? Because free man who is eager to tell his story is always surrounded by an audience willing to listen to his story. The slave has neither a story nor a curious audience. A slave is abused. A slave is mistreated. He's violated. He's taken advantage of. He's beaten. Nobody cares if he cries out. Nobody's listening. You're upset by the work you're being asked to do? Well, that's too bad. You're a slave. That's the nature of what it means to be a slave. Nobody's willing to listen to your cries. Nobody's willing to listen to your frustration. Nobody cares. You have no audience and you have no voice. Moreover, he is not merely a speechless being, but a mute being, what the halacha would call an ilam. Somebody who doesn't even have the ability to speak at all. Devoid not only of the word, but of the meaningful sound as well. You know, you look in the beginning of Parsha Shmos. Part of the difficulty that we have is that we read a different Parsha every week, and we think that everything happens in 1 week. So 1 week, Yosef was taken away to Mitzrayim, and then the next week his brothers came down to get food, and then the next week he revealed himself to his brothers, and then the next week all the Jewish people ended up in Mitzrayim, and then the next week the Sheev Mitzrayim started, the next week we came out. This was a period of hundreds of years. It didn't happen that way. So you look in the beginning of Parsha Shmos, and here we are, the Jewish people are in Mitzrayim, and it didn't happen in 1 week. And we're there for hundreds of years in Mitzrayim, and there's terrible oppression, and there's ruthless inhumanity that's going on there. You have such barbaric acts by the Egyptians that are taking place. And the Jewish people are being terribly oppressed and maltreated and persecuted by the Egyptians. And yet, says Rav Soloveitchik, line 29, before Moses came, there was not even a single sound. You look through the Parsha. Moshe Rabbeinu comes, and until he comes along on the scene, nobody says a word. So you're living through hundreds of years of a terrible experience, of an unbelievably cruel dictatorship, of absolute oppression, of unbelievably barbaric acts, of mothers losing their children, and similar kinds of events, and nobody says a word. Before Moshe came, there was not even a single sound. No complaint was lodged, no sigh, no cry uttered. Only an agonizing, unhuman shriek would penetrate the weird silence of the night. The slaves were gloomy, voiceless, and mute. The women did not cry when their infants were snatched from their arms. Which mother remains silent when such a thing takes place? You take a child out of a mother's arms, throw the child into the river, kill the baby, whatever you're going to do, and the mother just remains silent? It's not reasonable. It doesn't make sense. The men kept quiet when they were mercilessly tortured by the slave drivers. Torture was taken for granted. They thought this was the way it had to be. They became used to that kind of existence. He then quotes a long passage from the Zohar HaKadosh, and he explains it as follows. When Moshe came, the sound or the voice came into being. And he quotes the passage from the Zohar HaKadosh that's important to us is, Ki Asa Moshe, once Moshe Rabbeinu came along, Asa Kol, that's when a voice was generated. What does that mean, a voice was generated when Moshe Rabbeinu came along? Moshe, by defending the helpless Jews, restored sensitivity to the dull slaves. Suddenly they realized that all that pain, anguish, humiliation, and cruelty, all the greed and intolerance of man vis-a-vis his fellow man, is evil. Until the point that Moshe Rabbeinu made mention of the fact that life could be different, that you could be living a different existence, nobody even thought about it. This is the life that we've been born into. This is the experience we've become used to, and this is what it's going to be. How often do we hear about a spouse is in an abusive relationship for so many years? Why do you wait it out? You talk to a therapist. Why does the person wait it out so long? Well, for some people, they're afraid. Again, there are many, many reasons, but one of the things that they'll tell you is they didn't know any different. Got married at a young age. I became used to this style of marriage, and I never became aware of the fact that marriage could be any different. I never knew that it could be that a husband is able to talk respectfully to his wife, or that a wife can talk respectfully to her husband. I never knew that that was a possibility. Never dawned on me. And you can have somebody who's living in an abusive relationship for so many years simply because they don't know that there's another option. It never dawned on them to think about it. They're totally unaware, totally oblivious. That's exactly what happened in Mitzrayim. Hundreds of years the Jewish people are being subject to the worst oppression that the world has ever known, to terrible atrocities to humanity, to unbelievably barbaric acts, and yet nobody says a word. Why? Because they didn't know that there was an option. They didn't know that there was an option to have life that looked any different. This is what life is. Just like we all pay taxes, we don't think about it. This is what we're supposed to do. Take a step back and you say, wouldn't life be nice if we didn't have to pay all those thousands of dollars a year? Yeah, but that's not an option for us. So we don't even think about it. Now, what if a new king came along and said, well, how about we're going to have a new country where no one's going to have to pay taxes? I'll figure out how to raise the money on my own. No one's going to... Wow, that's a great idea. But nobody thinks about it. Nobody complains about it because this is the reality that we were born into. This is the society that we became used to. Line 45, with suffering came loud protest, the cry, the unuttered question, the wordless demand for justice and retribution. In short, the dead silence of non-existence was gone, and the voice of human existence was now heard. So when Moshe Rabbeinu came along, the Zohar says, Ki asa Moshe, asa kol. He gave us a voice. He gave us an opportunity to appreciate that life could be much better lived, that the conditions of life are able to improve. And until he came along and pointed that out to us, we were oblivious to that reality. Line 50. Why hadn't they cried before Moshe acted? Why were they silent during the many years of slavery that preceded Moshe's appearance? Suggests from Soloveitchik they had lacked the need awareness. They didn't know that they were needy. Someone who's in an abusive relationship doesn't realize that they have a need that's not being met. They think everything's fine. They're not aware that life could be different. And experience no need, whether for freedom, for dignity, or for painless existence. It never dawned on them that we need anything different than what we have right now, than what we're currently living through. And therefore, they never thought about the fact that we have need. If we don't have need, there's nothing to talk about. There's nothing to complain about. I'm not missing anything. I'm not lacking anything in my life. This story is indicative, says of Soloveitchik. Here's the big leap. This story, when we think about the Shibud Mitzrayim, when we think about that experience that the Jewish people had in Egypt, this story is indicative not only of the political slave of antiquity. It's not only talking about that description of our time in Mitzrayim, but of slavery today as well. Now you'll say, we don't have slavery as well. Hang on a minute. Slavery is not only a juridic economic institution of the past. This is not something that took place thousands of years ago in Mitzrayim. It's not something that took place hundreds of years ago in our communities. It is also a way of life which is still a reality. Slavery is something we still struggle with. It's something we still deal with. The unfree man differs existentially from the free man. One may existentially be a slave in the midst of political and economic freedoms. You know, we're blessed to live in a community, in a society, in an atmosphere where we have political freedoms, where we have religious freedoms, where we have economic freedoms. We have a parnasa, we have a job. We don't have to give all of our money away to someone else. We don't live in a dictatorship. We don't live under a czar. We have the opportunity to have economic freedoms, to have religious freedoms, to have all kinds of different freedoms, and nobody judges us, at least they're not supposed to judge us for our political views and our religious views and whatever it might be. We all have the incredible blessing to live as free people, and yet, in many ways, says of Soloveitchik, we are slaves. Here's the key line, line 64. What man fails to comprehend is not the world around him. We have a good understanding of the world. We read the newspaper, we understand what's happening, but the world within him. What we fail to understand is not all that goes on around us. We have a very good understanding of that. What we fail to understand is the world within us, particularly his destiny and the needs of which he is supposed to have a dear awareness. And here we begin. Many would say that to accuse modern man of being unaware of his needs is absurd. What do you mean I don't know what my needs are? I wake up every morning. I'm so overwhelmed because my Google Calendar tells me exactly what I have to do. 100 things every minute tells me everything to the minute, to the hour, what exactly I'm supposed to be scheduled to be doing today. So what do you mean I don't know what my needs are? I know very well. I got to go to the gym in the morning. I have to do this, do the carpools. I have to make lunches. I have other things I need to do. Right? So what does it mean we don't know what our needs are? We know quite well what the needs are. The reverse they would maintain is true. Listen how prophetic. Listen how authoritative these words are. Line 70. Modern man is aware of many needs. In fact, there are too many needs which claim his attention. Yes, we all have needs. But we all have so many needs that we forget who we really are. What are the needs that are really important to me? To make me successful in what I want to accomplish, in what my destiny is. An entire technology is bent upon generating more and more needs in order to give man the opportunity to derive pleasure through the gratification of artificially fabricated needs. Now, he was saying this when the advancement of technology was a radio. So, we laugh at what he was describing, but how true are those words? We have so many parts of technology that have become needs for us. I'll give myself as a personal example, and I'm sure many can relate to the same thing. Until 3.5, 4 years ago, I had a cell phone, and I never wanted to have texting. Not because I was such a frum Jew, but because I just didn't want to be bothered. So if somebody really wants to get in touch with me, you'll call me. And if somebody doesn't want to call me, they don't really need to get in touch with me. Correct? We all know it's true. So I didn't have a cell phone. I mean, I had a cell phone. I didn't have texting. 3.5 years ago, I was in the White Shul. And people said, you're not accessible. What do you mean? I have a phone, you can call me, but we need to be able to text you. But maybe I'm not interested. No, but that's, again, I'm not blaming anyone, but that's what the society became used to. So now, even though I define myself as someone who doesn't need this, it wasn't a need that I had, but I had to redefine my needs now, based on everybody around me. So everybody around me convinced me that this is a need that I have, when meanwhile, I have no interest in this need. It's not what I need in my life. And now I've become so addicted, like everybody else has, that here we are 3 years later, I can't live without it. My cell phone breaks that afternoon. I got to figure it out. You got to go. Why? What am I missing? What's the problem? What's going to happen? An email from Groupon, I'm going to miss it? Right? What's happening? What am I going to miss? A text from somebody who has nothing meaningful to share with me? Some silly picture or video that somebody sent me that I must watch right now? What am I missing? What is happening? It's because I redefined what my needs are, but it's not based on me. It's based on what everybody around me convinced me is a need for myself. Is it just me? It's all of us. And I think a cell phone is just one example. And I'm not, again, this has nothing to do with technology is good or bad. I'm not getting into the discussion. It's none of my business, but it's the reality. We have all redefined what our needs are. A cell phone nowadays, for probably almost all of us, a cell phone with texting and with emails and with everything else, is a necessity, is a need. It's a necessity that I myself felt I did not need a couple of years ago. And because of the way the community developed, all of a sudden everybody needs it. And all of a sudden I need it to fit in with the needs of everyone else, to be able to provide for what everybody else expects of me. It's an amazing phenomenon. Line 76. Though this assertion is true, it does not contradict my previous statement that contemporary man is unaware of his needs. Line 79, very important line. Man is surely aware of many needs, but the needs he is aware of are not always his own. The needs we're aware of are defined by our society, by our affiliations, by our communities, by our friends. They define what my needs are. How does that make sense? And we never have the opportunity to sit and think, who am I? What are my needs? What do I require in my life to be successful, to be happy? I never think about it. Because all that I think I need is defined and determined by everyone around me. 81. At the very root of this failure to recognize one's truly worthwhile needs lies man's ability to misunderstand and misidentify himself, which means, he writes, to lose himself. We get lost in the needs of other people. I'm no longer me. I'm now a product of everybody else. There is no me left anymore because I don't have my own needs that define myself. My needs are defined by everybody else, and therefore I am defined by everyone else. There is no me anymore. I lose myself. Quite often, man loses himself by identifying himself with the wrong image. Because of this misidentification, man adopts the wrong table of needs which he feels he must gratify. Man responds quickly to the pressure of certain needs, not knowing whose needs he is out to gratify. We forget where everything started. We forget that this is not the real me. This is not really what I need. This is not really something that's lacking in my life. You know, you have people who will sometimes resort to the most absurd measures to meet the needs that are not even their own. So I need to have those fancy shoes, but I don't have the money for them. So I'm willing to steal, or I'm willing to do something that's illegal, or I'm willing to put my reputation on the line, all for what? You need them? You need them only because society expects you to have them. If you would think deeply inside of yourself, is this really something I want to do? Is it worth going to jail for? For the new kitchen? Is it really a need in my personal life? Is it worth being caught? Is it worth all of the illegal activity I'm going to be involved in to finance whatever it is that I want, that I claim that I need? Well, if we would think very sincerely about it, we would probably say, not really worth it. Not really a smart thing to do. But because we redefined what our needs are, we have to meet that. And it's not a redefinition that we've created. It's something that all of those around us have often forced us to feel that we need. Line 91. Does the young man understand his basic needs? If he did, we would have no problem of crime, drugs, and permissiveness in general. Why does someone resort to drugs? Again, there could be a million and one reasons, but one of the assertions that he's making is maybe it happens because the child says, this is what I need to be happy. If I don't have that, I'm not fulfilling my needs. Now, if you ask an objective person, that's not what you need. Really? If you go on drugs and you end up homeless in the street for the rest of your life, that's what you need? You have an understanding of what you need. Society around you, your group of friends that's doing this, convinces you that that's what you need. But it's not really objectively what you need. It's not going to make you happy. It's not going to make you successful, and it's not going to help you meet your destiny or your potential. Line 93. Does the old man know what should and what should not matter to him? Let me speak for myself. I know that I am perplexed, that my fears are irrational and incoherent. At times I am given over to panic. I am afraid of death. At other times I am horrified by the thought of becoming, God forbid, incapacitated during my lifetime. I don't know what to fear, what not to fear. I am utterly confused and ignorant. And here's the line 102. Modern man is indeed existentially a slave because he is ignorant and fails to identify his own needs. So you'll say, slavery is a concept that existed thousands of years ago in Mitzrayim. That is the description of who all of us are today as well. We can live in a society where we have political, economical, religious freedoms. But yet we are still slaves to our society because we cannot define what our needs are anymore for our own personal destiny. People have such a difficult time doing that. We can be classified as servants, no longer presenting our voices the way a servant is defined, the way our Soloveitchik began. And that's the society, that's the reality that we live in. Now Rav Soloveitchik presents the problem. The problem is when you contrast the slave of Mitzrayim with the slave of today that we're all living through, there's a major issue. Line 105. How can one redeem oneself from this kind of slavery? The redemption from Egypt was completely an act of the Almighty. The Ribbono Shel Olam took us out of Mitzrayim. Liberty and speech were returned to the people by him in an act of endless grace and benevolence. Va'avarti be'eretz Mitzrayim b'layla hazeh, ani v'lo malach, God says. I'm going to take you out of Mitzrayim, ani v'lo ha-shaliach. No one else is going to do it. God himself promises us, I'm going to be the one to take care of that redemption. And we say in the Haggadah, lo yidei malach v'lo yidei shaliach el HaKadosh Baruch Hu b'chvodo v'atzmo, God himself came down and redeemed us from Mitzrayim. Well, that's easy. You can be enslaved somewhere. If someone else comes and takes you out, that makes life very easy. But now, the slavery that we're living in, nobody's offering to come and extricate us from it. So what do? We don't have a promise from God. Ani v'lo malach, ani v'lo ha-shaliach. Line 111. The case of existential slavery is, however, different. It is up to man who is charged with the task of redeeming himself from a shadow existence. So here's the difference. When we as a nation are enslaved in Mitzrayim, God promises, I will take you out. When we as a people are enslaved in our society, in our community, it's our job to redeem ourselves. God willed man to be a creator. This was a recurrent theme that Rav Soloveitchik spoke about in so many different contexts. Mahu af ata, the same way God acts is the way we are supposed to act. The same way he's a racham v'chanan, he's kind and benevolent and compassionate. We're supposed to be the same way. Said of Soloveitchik, the same way God was a creator, he created the world, we have the obligation to be creative as well and innovative. Man's first job is to create himself as a complete being. Man, the mute being, must search for speech and find it all by himself. It's a difficult task. Man comes into our world as a hilik, amorphous being. He is created in the image of God. But this image is a challenge to be met, not a gratuitous gift. When we say we're all created b'tzelem Elokim, it means you have to create that tzelem Elokim. You need to make for yourself a voice. You need to define for yourself, what is my destiny? And it's not easy. You're not created b'tzelem Elokim and then everything's given to you. You have to prove, says Rav Soloveitchik, it is up to man to objectify himself, to impress form upon the latent formless personality, and to move from the hillock silent periphery toward the center of objective reality. Man was commanded to redeem himself in order to attain full being. How do we do that? I don't know how to redeem myself. I don't even know what those words mean. I understand that I'm a slave to society, I'm a slave to everything that is around me, How do I redeem myself? Says of Soloveitchik, Lon 25. This can be achieved only through prayer. Now, what does that mean? How so? How does tefillah answer the question to how a person is able to redeem themselves? Listen to this. It is so beautiful. Judaism, in contradistinction to mystical quietism, which recommended toleration of pain, wants man to cry out loud against any kind of pain, to react indignantly to all kinds of injustice and unfairness. The Torah expects us to react when there's atrocities being committed in the world. When there are people being killed in Syria, the Torah expects us to react. It doesn't mean giving money. Sometimes it means that. It means feeling compassion. It means doing something about it. When we have people that are suffering in the world, we're supposed to feel it. We're supposed to speak up. That's the Torah's perspective. For Judaism held that the individual who displays indifference to pain and suffering, if you don't understand what it means to be in pain and suffering, who meekly reconciles himself to the ugly, disproportionate, and unjust in life, is not capable of appreciating beauty and goodness. Whoever permits his legitimate needs to go unsatisfied will never be sympathetic to the crying needs of others. If you say, I don't have any needs, well then you don't understand why anyone else needs anything. Because why are they different than I? There are great tzaddikim who have said that perhaps the reason why, again, we never know, Rabbas Machshavas Belevish, we never understand really what's going on. But there are those who have stated that perhaps the reason why God held them back from having children for a number of years, as painful and as awful as that experience is, Shalom Neida. But there are many great people who have said it was in order that they should have the understanding later on in life when people come and consult with them about the issue that they're going through of infertility, at least you can relate to it because it's a need that you had. It's something you can relate to. There are those of us who have suffered tragedies, unfortunately. People have had miscarriages. People have lost children at a young age. You can relate to someone else now because you understand what that loss is. You understand what suffering is. To someone who doesn't understand what that experience means, they don't understand why it's painful to someone else that goes through it. They have a very shallow understanding, and they say, well, let them get over it. What's the big deal? It happens. Yes, it happens. But you don't understand what the need of the other person is because you haven't been through it. Because you never spent the time recognizing what it is that they're suffering through. Judaism expects us, Yiddishkeit expects us, to make note of the fact that there is suffering in the world. To talk about it, to think about it, to consider it. Line 138. A human morality based on love and friendship, on sharing in the travail of others, cannot be practiced if the person's own need awareness is dull and he does not know what suffering is. Hence, Judaism rejected models of existence which deny human needs, such as the angelic or the monistic. We all know that the priests have to swear to celibacy, abstention, extreme constraint. Why is that? Because you're so holy, you shouldn't think that you need anything. You shouldn't need that aspect of life. Why do you have to be married? We believe there's nothing wrong with being married. It's a need. We're all human beings. A woman needs a man needs a woman. It makes a lot of sense. We don't swear to celibacy. We don't believe in that principle. Why? Because we believe that human beings are created with needs, with deficiencies, with things that other people can fill in. There's nothing wrong with that. That's what we believe in. For Judaism, need awareness constitutes part of the definition of human existence. Therefore, line 147, prayer in Judaism, unlike the prayer of classical mysticism, is bound up with the human needs, wants, drives, and urges which can make man suffer. Prayer is the doctrine of human needs. Prayer tells the individual as well as the community what his or its genuine needs are, what he should or should not petition God about. So we have an opportunity to daven every day. The Shemona Esrei gives us the ability to reevaluate what my needs actually are. You know, you ask someone, it's often been asked, most often by high school kids, because they're the ones who struggle with tefillah more so. Maybe by high school adults, I don't know. Because many of us learned how to daven in fourth grade, and our davening has not progressed since then. We're davening the same words of the Shemona Esrei that we were davening then, and we have the same basic level of understanding that we had then, and we never bothered to change that. So many have asked, why is it that we say the same words in Shemoneh Esrei every day? Why do we have the same text? Wouldn't it be easier to have Kavanah if I was able to express myself in my own words? So why did Chazal institute the text of the Shemoneh Esrei? And here I am, flipping the pages every day, saying the same thing. Why is that? So there are many answers that are given. One answer that I've been told by those involved in Kiruv is, you know, sometimes you have a Kiruv opportunity, and they gather all the kids or whatever it is together, and they don't know how to read Hebrew, but you explain to them that there's this idea of prayer, you can express yourself to God, you can say whatever you want, so now we're going to give 5 minutes, everybody close your eyes, you can talk to God. Now, of course, the counselor keeps their eyes open and looks around what's going on. And you will notice nobody has anything to say. Give people an opportunity to express themselves to God in any words that they choose. You try to formulate how you're going to say it and what you're going to say. It's not as easy as you think. You give people the opportunity, I guarantee you, in most cases, you will have a silent room where nobody has anything to say. You won't use up those 5 minutes, even though you have more than 5 minutes to talk to God about. More than 5 minutes of needs, of things that are troubling you. But to formulate the words is such a difficulty, and some suggest that's why it was formulated for us, because if we just came to shul every day and told everyone, okay, now you have an hour, you can talk to God, say whatever you want, you would not fill that hour. You wouldn't figure out what to say. So they told us what to say. That's one suggestion. Says Rav Soloveitchik, you want to know another reason why there's a Shemoneh Esrei? Because if I would ask you, you wake up in the morning, what are your basic list of 10 needs? What is most important to you to take care of in your life, if I would ask you right now? Losing weight? Very much up there. And yet you look through all of Shemoneh Esrei, nowhere is there a bracha, please God help me lose weight. Right? And we all have things that we think are very important needs. I need that new car, I need the new kitchen. It's very important to me. But when you re-examine what really is important to you, and what really is a priority, what is essential, what the urgencies of my life are, you remind yourself, yeah, all things I thought I needed probably pale in comparison to the things that are really important to me. And the Shemoneh Esrei, says of Soloveitchik, is the opportunity for us every single day to remind ourselves of what it is that is really a priority to me. You look through the brachos in the Shemoneh Esrei, and Chazal are teaching us what is supposed to be important to you. What is a need that you're lacking in your life? How many people would say on their list of 10 needs, if I asked anyone, I really need Yerushalayim. I need a Beis HaMikdash. I need God to accept my tshuva. I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't put that on my list of top priorities. I wouldn't feel that I'm inadequate because I don't have a Beis HaMikdash. And yet the Shemoneh Esrei reminds us every day, no, no, no. Those are your needs. That's the real you. That's the Moshe Rabbeinu coming every day and reminding us, Ki asa Moshe asa kol. You're a slave to society. You're a slave to your environment. You're a slave to your community. You're a slave to your country. And remind yourself every day in the Shemoneh Esrei who you really are. Take the time out to remember what is really important to you in life. What is really essential? What is a need that you cannot live without? Rifa'enu. That's a need that Chazal just you cannot live without. Baruch Aleinu, we daven for a parnasa. Don't ever think that a parnasa is a secular idea. That's something that every human being needs. And it's put into the Shemoneh Esrei for a reason, to remind us, yes, that's something you should look forward to. It's something you need to pray for because it's something that without it, you will not have a meaningful life. It's something that without it, you will suffer, you will struggle. It's a need that we have. It's Chazal telling us that is a priority. And so is Yerushalayim, and so is a Beis HaMikdash, and so is your tshuva. That's what the Shemoneh Esrei gives us the opportunity to think about every day. Line 157. We're going to end at 175, so another 4 minutes. Who prays? Only the sufferer prays. If man does not find himself in narrow straits, if he is not troubled by anything, if he knows not what Sarah is, then he need not pray. To a happy man, to a contented man, to the secret of prayer was not revealed. God needs neither thanks nor hymns. The Ribbono Shel Olam is not waiting every day to hear, oh, what are they going to say about me? Are they happy with what I gave them? He doesn't need it. He's not interested. He wants to hear the outcry of man confronted with a ruthless reality. He expects prayer to rise from a suffering world cognizant of its genuine needs. In short, and here we go, sums it all up. Through prayer, man finds himself. Tila'i, opportunity for us to redeem ourselves from the slavery, from the prison that we find ourselves in. We have redefined through our experiences of life what our needs are. Tfila gives us the opportunity to reevaluate, to reassess what my needs really are. I'm not going to make my needs those of the people around me. I'm going to reevaluate what my own needs are by saying the Shemona Esrei. Prayer enlightens man about his needs. It tells man the story of the hidden hopes and expectations. It teaches him how to behold the vision and how to strive in order to realize this vision. When to be satisfied and when one with what one possesses and when to reach out for more. In a word, man finds his need awareness, which is himself in prayer. And of course, the very instant he finds himself, he becomes a redeemed being. That's what tefillah is all about. This is why the question that we started with, why is it important that we always mention Gal Yisrael? We talk about Shibud Mitzrayim and our redemption from Mitzrayim. Right before we begin our Shemoneh Esrei, you know why? Because we remind ourselves of the task that we have. By Mitzrayim Anivalo Malach, God is the one who took us out of Mitzrayim. He's the one who redeemed us. He's the one who gave us freedom, who gave us a voice. He sent Moshe Rabbeinu. Once Moshe Rabbeinu came, it opened our horizons. There could be life that looks different than the terrible, oppressive lifestyle that we're living here in Mitzrayim. And yet, when it comes to our slavery that we all find ourselves in, we don't have that blessing. We don't have that gift. God does not promise us that He's going to be the one to take us out of this misery, of this need that we feel is so important and essential. And that's what tefillah gives us the opportunity to do every day. To reevaluate, to reassess, to reconsider and reexamine all of the priorities that we have, what the emphasis is supposed to be on. Those brachas and Shemoneh Esrei remind us that there are things in life that are urgent, there are things in life that are necessities, and there are things in life that are considered to be deficiencies and inadequacies. And without that Shemoneh Esrei to remind us every day of what it means to be a free person, to reclaim your own identity, to understand what it is that I need in my life, we can continue to remain slaves for the rest of our existence. It's an incredible blessing that the Shemoneh Esrei gives us every day. And this suggestion of Soloveitchik is perhaps the reason why we have such a focus on making sure that every day before the Shemoneh Esrei, both in Shacharis and in Maariv, to always remind ourselves of the fact that we were slaves in Mitzrayim, that we have the opportunity for redemption, and the same way we were slaves in Mitzrayim and we were redeemed then, we have the opportunity to be slaves in the world and the lives that we live today, and to redeem ourselves and extricate our beings from the enslavement that we find ourselves in the current, in our society that we all inhabit. Yes?